Chapter 9. Rosie, present day, Friday, 11 a.m., Branston, Connecticut. Another hour passed quickly. Rosie and Gabe drove in his car to meet Joe on Richmond Street. There was a frenzied discussion about what to do next, and again, whether they should call the police. Gabe didn't weigh in. This was their call. And in the end, Rosie's. It was her sister who would have to live with the consequences, one way or the other. Joe didn't have to say it. The impact it could have on Laura, on her emotional stability if they dredged up her past and forced her out of the shadow of anonymity she had created. Gabe was the only one of them who was not reeling with fear, and on his face, Rosie could see something even worse. Resignation. Time felt precious, but that's all it was. A feeling, an urgency fed by the panic of not knowing. If something bad had happened, it was over. They were already too late. Rosie made the decision, though without the conviction she'd had even an hour before when they were standing in her kitchen. They would wait. Joe took her minivan back to the house, and she took his car and followed Gabe to the waterfront, where Laura's phone had last sent a signal. The exact location was a parking lot between an office building and a gym. But that meant nothing. People coming to the restaurants and bars parked in all of the lots, and along the streets as well. So they walked the streets and the paths between them, stopping in apartment buildings, asking people if they recognized any of the men from findlove.com. They had narrowed the thumbnail photos down to 27. Laura had said enough about him to rule out the rest. Full head of hair, clean-shaven, fit. Still, it was a needle in a haystack, and they landed back at the street where they'd parked their cars, with nothing helpful. Gabe laid the sheets of photos on his hood, studying the faces. "Do you recognize any of them?" Rosie asked. Gabe sometimes talked about his cases. Most of what he did was more mundane, working out glitches in corporate computer systems. But for his other work, using IT to investigate spouses, it was invariably women who hired him. And it always made Rosie think of her mother.
"Funny you should say that," Gabe answered. "The last case where I needed to sort through this shitty website was Melissa's. Her husband was trolling for younger women under a fake profile."
"Sorry," Rosie said. Gabe and Melissa liked to forget this little fact about how they met.
"No, don't be. You know it's okay to sleep with your client as long as you marry her."
Gabe gave her a wink, and Rosie managed a smile. But the levity slipped away quickly.
"Some of these guys have been on here for years. This one," Gabe pointed to a man with a seductive smile, holding a fish at the end of a line. "He was on here 2-3 years ago, before Melissa's case. I remember this stupid fish."
Rosie looked at the picture. "We should cross him off the list. Laura would have mentioned the fish. She would have found it ridiculous." Gabe took out a pen and put an X through the photo.
"Yeah," he agreed. "She would have psychoanalyzed the hell out of it. A pathetic attempt to convey success, manliness, dominion.
It's a curse and a blessing, how she sees through everything and everyone."
Gabe's face returned to resignation. "Except herself," he said. "She never understood why she did the things she did."
Rosie began pacing the sidewalk, arms folded around herself, squinting from the sun, which was almost directly overhead. She checked her phone. It was 11.
"The restaurants should be open now," Gabe said. "Most of them serve lunch. The staff will be setting up."
Gabe had read her mind. Rosie stopped talking and looked at the massive complex lining the water. "I've only been to the park. Mason doesn't have the patience to sit at a restaurant." Gabe pointed to a street off to their right.
"We've been down here, Melissa and I. Young crowd, younger than we are. Except for the divorced men. They come here to shop at these places, like kids in a candy store. They're all pretty much on one block. There, 2 streets down."
Gabe started walking.
"We should get started."
They went to 3 places before getting a lead. It was at a bar that served food, very bad bar food,
but enough to keep people from leaving when they got drunk and hungry. The atmosphere was dark, and it smelled of stale beer. They spoke to the bartender who had just opened up. He glanced at the photos, reluctantly at first, until Rosie told him that her sister was missing. His eyes focused harder then, returning to each photo to study the men. Then a smile came and left in an instant.
"Yep," he said, pointing at one of the men. "This guy. He's a regular."
The photo was attached to the screen name, Here For You.
"Why did you smile when you saw him? What's funny about it?"
Gabe asked. The bartender paused, glancing at Rosie, then looking away as though he didn't want to see her expression change when he answered the question. Instead, he looked only at Gabe.
"This guy comes in during the week. One, maybe two times, never on the weekend. Thursdays are his favorite."
"So he was here last night?" Rosie asked.
She looked at Gabe, wide-eyed, then back to the bartender.
"Every Thursday."
Rosie frantically pulled out her phone and found a photo of Laura. She was in their backyard, pushing Mason on the swing.
"Was he here with this woman? Do you recognize her?"
The bartender leaned in close to see the picture, then shook his head.
"I don't know. There are so many people who come and go every night. Maybe."
Gabe was suddenly frustrated, standing taller with both hands on the bar.
"How are you sure you saw this guy then? If there are so many people coming and going."
The bartender leaned back defensively.
"I know the guy because he's a regular. Sits in the back corner, gets the drinks at the bar, pays cash, leaves a shitty tip."
"Does he ever come in with a woman? A date?" Gabe asked.
"Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Comes on the weekdays, usually with a different woman."
"A different woman each time?" Rosie asked.
The bartender nodded.
"Yeah, all different ages, races, thin, not so thin, short hair, long hair. He doesn't have a type. Doesn't seem too picky either."
Rosie gasped.
"God, it's him. It's got to be," she said.
"Hold on." Gabe pointed to the man's picture again. "You're sure? This man? Oh, yeah. See that smug smile? How it curls up more on one side? Wears it every time," he said. "Cheap son of a bitch. Never even orders as much as a French fry."
"You got a name?" Gabe asked.
"No. Like I said, pays cash and sits in the back." "But wait."
He scratched his head as though ushering a memory. "A few weeks ago, he went to the bathroom, and this chick he was with called over a waitress and bought a round with her credit card. We had a laugh about it. First time we got a decent tip from a table he was at, but only because the woman was the one who paid."
"Is she here? That waitress?"
Rosie's eyes were scanning the place, but it was empty. The bartender shook his head.
"She works nights. I can try to reach her. You got a number or a card or something? If she can remember what night, what they were drinking, we might be able to find the slip. It would at least give you the name of one of his dates."
Gabe pulled a business card from his wallet. He wrote Rosie's cell phone number on the back and handed it to the bartender.
"Try us both. It doesn't matter," he said, "as soon as you hear from her."
"Will do," the bartender said. "And text me that picture of your sister. I'll get it to everyone who worked last night. I really hope you find her. If it's any consolation, he seemed harmless. Just another asshole working his game."
"Thanks, man."
Gabe shook his hand, but Rosie couldn't wait. She was walking fast, back to their cars on the street. Gabe grabbed her arm and stopped her.
"Hey," he said, "this is good news. Laura was here last night. We know from her phone records. This has to be our guy. And now we can find him. And then find Laura."
"I know you're thinking the same thing I am," Rosie said, pulling her arm away. "It's why I haven't called the police. It's why you haven't made me."
"Rosie."
"No, we have to stop. We have to think this through."
"There's nothing to think through. We found Jonathan Fields. He's a harmless womanizer."
"Gabe."
She looked at him with dismay. It was not possible that he was forgetting.
"She didn't get back in my car. The parking tickets, one right after she got to Richmond Street, and one in the morning. There are only two things that could have happened last night.
I know, Rosie. You think I don't know? We've stayed in touch, but it hasn't been easy having her back. Seeing the pain that's always there. And Melissa, she doesn't want me anywhere near your sister, because even she knows, just from the stories she's heard, the things that can happen around her.
Gabe was angry, and it was unsettling. Rosie could count on one hand the number of times she'd seen him lose his composure. He calmed himself before continuing.
I can almost see her last night. That look in her eyes as she falls in love with him. And I can see the rage as she finds out that he's a con artist. I know them all. Every one of her faces, and I know where they lead her.
Then you know, Rosie said, pleading. If this guy was a player, a liar, and if Laura found out, it wouldn't matter how harmless he was.
But Gabe wasn't listening. She always said that word, love, as though it were an object, something that could be held and touched. She spoke of it as though it wasn't all around her, from you and Joe and Mason, from all of us, and from all of those men who tried to love her. It isn't like that. I've tried to tell her. When I met Melissa, it just grew, and it took work. I tried to tell her.
Rosie wanted to scream. So did I, a million times. How it sometimes works. Just getting up every day and deciding that you are going to love this person, even though it's not sweeping you off your feet. It's like she's been on a desperate search her whole life. It's on her face in that picture, the one on the computer. Even back then.
Gabe shook off the frustration and closed his eyes tight. And for that brief moment, Rosie knew exactly what he was feeling.
Look at what followed. What happened to her first real boyfriend, Rosie said. What if it happened again? With this man, Jonathan Fields.
She paused briefly before saying the rest, all of her thoughts fusing together, becoming simple, becoming clear.
The thing is, Gabe, I'm not worried about what he might have done to her. I'm worried about what she might have done to him.
Gabe nodded, growing solemn again. Let's get back to the house, he said. I know how to find this guy. That's all we can do now. They got in their cars, pulled away from the curb, and drove away from the harbor.
Chapter 10. Laura. Session number 7. 3 months ago. New York City. Laura. Maybe I've just been unlucky in love. Isn't that a song? Or in a song? There's another expression. What is it? The heart wants what it wants. Dr. Brody.
But if that heart is broken, it will want all the wrong things.
Laura. Cheery. But are you saying that's me? My heart is broken? Dr. Brody.
It's just a euphemism, Laura. Hearts don't break.
Laura. Obviously. But people do, don't they? Dr. Brody.
In a manner of speaking. When do you want to talk about it?
Laura. Talk about what? I tell you everything. Dr. Brody.
About what really happened that night in the woods.
Chapter 11. Laura. The night before. Thursday, 9 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. We walk on the path along the water. The air is perfect, neither hot nor cold against the skin. It smells of salt and seaweed, the smell of the ocean. It is blissful. And it fills me with despair. I tried to explain this to the shrink, how a perfect night provokes the longing so hard and fast that it feels as though it will explode right out of me. Perfect nights were made for lovers. We stroll together, me and Jonathan Fields, taking in this perfect night with its air and its smells, and the desire to be past this moment, and the ones that have to follow, so that maybe we will stroll as lovers and not strangers. The desire to be in love on this perfect night that is screaming out for lovers rises all the way to my throat. I hold my breath to keep it inside. My cheeks flush and he notices, but we continue to stroll. I make myself exhale and take a new breath, and it begins to pass. Jonathan Fields. I like the way he strolls, his hands in his jean pockets, the button-down shirt tucked in. He's rolled up his sleeves, and I can see the hair on his forearms, light brown. He's not like a bear or anything. It's that masculine thing again. I don't know why I like it so much. Rosie likes it too. That's why she fell for Joe. He was a guy from the day he was born, a dude. I've wondered if Dick was like that, and maybe that's why we are drawn to the same men. I can't remember, not even a little bit, about whether our father had hair on his arms or his chest, and whether he strolled the way Jonathan Fields strolls now, with a little swagger and a little nonchalance. Confidence, maybe. Or maybe arrogance. We walk for a while, looking at people, laughing when we see others who seem to be on a first date, as though we are better than them because we at least recognize the absurdity of it, the awkwardness. We smell the air and take in the anticipation of where we will go next, and what we will do there. I can tell he's thinking about it. His face changes with the thoughts, though I don't think he is aware of it. But I am. I am aware of everything. And I have not forgotten about the car, or the woman in the bar, or the holes in his story. I have not forgotten that we are not lovers on this perfect night that screams out for them. I grow quiet.
Are you all right?
He asks. I nod and smile. And then he does something miraculous. He reads my mind.
We love the beach, my wife and I, he says.
Ex-wife, I think. But I don't correct him. It's a habit, that's all it is. Isn't it?
After it got so hard to have kids, we stopped going. Because all of a sudden there were kids everywhere at the beach. They were in the surf with their fathers who threw them in the air. They were building sandcastles. They were chasing seagulls. I'm sure they had always been there. But after we couldn't get pregnant, the nicer the beach day was, the harder it was to stomach what was missing for us on that beach.
I've gathered myself once again. I'm calmed by his story, which is just like mine. A beach without a child. A perfect night without lovers. I never got kids, I say, until my nephew was born. And even then, it wasn't until he started to know me that I could understand the power children wield. Jonathan looks at me now, a question causing his eyes to narrow. Only I can't read his mind the way he's read mine.
I thought you hadn't been back much, he asks.
Again with the questions about my past. What the fuck? Still, I answer. I came home for holidays, usually just a night or an afternoon. But my sister would bring Mason to the city. He knows me. He does. I stop then, because he doesn't deserve to know more. How Mason learned to say Lala before Dada. Aunt Lala. I have a name he's given just to me. And when he sees me, his face lights up with a million colors of delight. I know where he likes to be tickled, and I know how hard to toss him on my bed into the fluffy comforter. I know how long to chase him before his laughter will give him hiccups. And I know how soft his skin feels when I kiss his cheek. So fuck you, Jonathan Fields. My nephew knows me.
Does it make you think about it?
He asks then. I can feel him trying to pull me back. What, having kids?
Yeah, of course.
I've been waiting for this question. I shake my head. It scares me even more, I say.
Scares you? Why?
He asks. Because they're so easy to break. Rosie says this all the time. She says it scares her, so of course it scares me. Now he grows silent, and I wonder if he's picturing me picking up a child and breaking it in two. But that's not what I mean. It's a big responsibility to be a parent, to know what to say and what not to say. Kids are blank slates, and everything we draw on them stays forever. He gives me a curious, huh, Like he's never had this thought. Like all the years he wanted a child, he never thought what he would do with one after it arrived. And I think he is normal, and I am not. But then I am the one who can still read the things that were drawn on me as a child. Fists for hands, so hard to love. And the eyes that never looked down at me, no matter how long I held my desperate gaze. Jonathan Fields has stopped walking. It's my mood. He can feel it rolling in and out like the current we hear in the distance.
Something's been on your mind since we left the first bar, hasn't it?
God damn, Jonathan Fields, you really are inside my head, aren't you? So much has been on my mind, but I know what he means from the words he's chosen, since we left that first bar. So I say it. That woman, from the bar on Richmond Street, the one who called your name as we were leaving. He knew this was coming, so his answer leaves his mouth as smooth as silk.
She was a woman I went out with a few weeks ago.
My heart sinks. It begins to drown. Who runs away from a woman who calls your name? A woman you dated? An asshole, that's who. Did you meet her on Find Love? I manage to ask. It's hard to speak when your heart is drowning. He nods.
We went out on 3 dates.
3 dates, I say. It's the magic number, the industry standard. Sex on the 3rd date maintains some decorum, but prevents the wasting of precious time if things aren't good enough in that department. I've done my research. Now he looks away, embarrassed as well.
Yeah, 3 dates. She came back to my apartment. It was really weird. I feel bad saying that, saying anything about another woman. Don't kiss and tell, right?
I can't answer. I need him to finish.
I told her the next day I didn't think it was a good fit.
He looks at me then with a strange kind of earnest, the kind that I usually feel spreading when I'm desperate to be understood.
I thought it was the right thing to do, not later on. Let her find someone else. Shit, it's not like there aren't a ton of other men just like me on every dating site and app and...
He sighs and leans his elbows on the metal rail that lines the boardwalk, keeping people from jumping at moments like this one. I find words.
So what happened?
He shakes his head and clasps his hands together.
She wouldn't stop texting, calling. I responded for about a week, but then I told her I was going to stop, and I did. She still sends angry texts every day. I saw her after you walked in, and I knew we had to get the hell out of there.
I consider all this information. I don't like it, but this actually makes me feel good. Maybe it's pathetic, but I feel happy that with all the things I've done chasing after love, I have never been a stalker. Texts, calls, emails, nothing. I smile, and he catches me.
What?
He asks. I start laughing because I actually believe him and now feel relieved. My heart crawls out of the sinkhole. Is it terrible that I'm wondering what happened on that 3rd date in your apartment that made you realize it wasn't a good fit? I make quotation marks in the air with my fingers. My mood has taken another drastic turn. Now he laughs as well.
Sometimes there's just no chemistry. You must have walked away from men for similar reasons.
Again, he turns the light on my past, but we are not going down that road. It's a giant candy store, isn't it? I say instead. Only you get to try everything before you have to buy it. Take a bite, good but not perfect, pick up another, take a bite, better maybe, or worse. Maybe the first was better. He nods.
Exactly like that. And when it's the second time around, there's fear.
Because you know there's a chance you'll be wrong? That what tastes good in the store won't be as good when you take it home? I ask.
And, he says, holding up a finger like Sherlock Holmes, there's even more fear that you're the candy.
Ah, I say, true. I look at him and try to think this. He's the candy. I'm the one choosing the flavor. But no, they are just words. He knows it. Somehow, men are never the candy. Never, never, never. We start to walk again. He leads me back to the street where he's parked the car that's all wrong, that's on my list of concerns. But at least I've crossed the woman from the bar off the list, because his story has convinced me.
So how did your sister meet her husband?
He asks now. I'm the candy, so I try to be sweet and give him an answer. We all grew up together, I begin. I go on and on then about Rosie and Joe and Gabe Wallace and the tree I used to climb and the skunk cabbage and the frog eggs. It gushes out of me, the words, the stories, no longer to please him, but because they live inside me, flowing on a river of joy and sorrow, hot lava and cold water, wet, dirty clothes, sunbaked skin, laughter, freedom, bloody fists and tears and clear lines, black and white. There were no shades of gray when we were young, before we learned that everything is gray. I stop, though. I don't tell him about my first boyfriend and how he ended up dead.
So your sister and her husband were friends from birth. That's a great story, he says. I have to admit, it makes me sad, though.
Why? I ask.
It reminds me of me and my wife, friends from college. There is something about meeting when you're young like that, before you learn to hide.
We get to his car and he clicks open the locks. He stands beside me and opens my door. What is it you're hiding? I ask him. I can't help it. He opened that door as well. Then he answers,
I could ask you the same thing.
And there is something in his voice that stops me again. He wants to know about my past. Why? I've been fading in and out of dreams and nightmares. I look at him and neither of us speaks. I wonder which is real, which is the truth. Is this a dream or a nightmare? How long does it take, I also wonder, to know? Our mother didn't know what was in her husband's heart or mind, even after 18 years, sharing a bed, sharing a bathroom, sharing meals and vacations and births of children. I can't see behind the eyes of a man I just met, but I'm not at all sure time is the reason. I should fear the possibility that this is a nightmare, and I should not get back in this car that's all wrong. But I can't bear to let go of the hope that this is a dream and the knowledge that no amount of time will give me the answer. We might still be strangers even after we become lovers.
Come on, he says. Let's head back to town.
There is a faint whisper in my brain as I get in the car. What is it you're hiding? He never answered. Still, I let Jonathan Fields close the door.
Chapter 12. Rosie, present day, Friday, 12 p.m., Branston, Connecticut. Back at Rosie's house, Gabe created a new account on findlove.com. The screen name was Here For You Too. The photo was the screenshot of Jonathan Fields, the man the bartender identified. The profile was live by noon. They selected women like Laura, mid-20s to early 30s, never been married, no children, living within 10 miles of Branston, and pretty. They sent emails to over 60 profiles. The subject line read, Do you know this man? The body of the email contained a plea from one woman to another. I met this guy online and I'm worried something's not right about him. Did he ever contact you? Gabe left his cell number and Rosie's. 1 in 100 profiles on this site is fake. Avatars. Fake pictures and enticing information. It's almost always women who do it. They use an avatar to contact the guys they're seeing, or sometimes their husbands, boyfriends. Then they wait to see if he responds, if he wants to meet. That confirms he's cheating or lying. You get the idea. Rosie nodded, staving off panic. A plan was in place. They would wait for a reply. And while they waited, Gabe would comb through the papers in Laura's room again, see what he could find that might help them. Rosie would start calling the people she knew from Laura's life. There were surprisingly few, she realized, and this made her uneasy, guilty. She had been so consumed with her own life since Mason was born. She would start with a casual call to Laura's work colleague named Jill, and Laura's old roommate, Kathleen, the one she'd never met because she spent weekends in New Jersey. Gabe knew how to find their numbers. She would also get in touch with Asshole in New York City, if she could figure out who he was. She would be careful not to raise concerns in case this was nothing, and Laura wanted to return to her life without having to explain why her crazy sister called in a panic looking for her. She fixed a cup of coffee and placed it on the table next to her phone and Laura's computer. It was 2:30 when she heard the door.
We're home.
Joe set Mason down and he ran to his mother. Rosie scooped him up and hugged him tight. How was the park, love bug? She closed her eyes, breathed him in, tried to pull herself back from the urgency of the situation. She knew he could feel it. He squirmed from her arms and ran to the corner where they kept his toys. That left Joe, standing with her in the kitchen, his eyes shifting from her to Mason and out to the street where Gabe's car was parked.
No luck? Joe asked.
Rosie told him about Jonathan Fields and the bar where Laura's phone had been. They had his picture and his screen name, and how there might be another woman who went on a date with him, who used a credit card. Maybe they could find her. Maybe she would know more about him. Joe looked quickly at the clock above the sink.
It's almost 3.
I know.
We should call.
Footsteps pounded the stairs. Gabe walked in, empty-handed.
I have her social security number. That's all I found. It was on a reimbursement form.
Rosie got up from the table and joined them at the island.
I think we need to call the police, Joe said again, filling the brief silence.
But then something new came across Gabe's face. Something she didn't recognize. It looked like guilt, or shame, maybe. And it didn't suit him.
I need to tell you both something. I don't know that it matters.
Jesus, Gabe, what? Rosie had her phone in her hand. Joe was right. It was time.
And now this? Maybe it's nothing. Maybe I'm just pulling together memories to make sense of things. I hadn't thought about any of this for years, but it's been playing in my head since you called this morning. A memory? Of what? When we were kids? What are you talking about? Joe asked.
Gabe closed his eyes, hung his head. Jesus, was he trying to see it more clearly, this memory from the past? Or not wanting to see them when he finally said the words? Rosie was losing patience.
Just tell us, Gabe. What do you know? It has to do with my brother.
Joe was quick to respond.
Rick?
Yeah, before he left home.
For the military school. But that was so long ago. Laura was, what, 11?
Rosie remembered Gabe's brother. Rick had been a troublemaker. 2 years older than Gabe. 4 years older than Laura. But he had never been their friend. Rick Wallace was the vicious dog whose house you ran past, hoping he wouldn't see you. Joe had gotten into it with him more than once. Fists flying, even as young boys. Mrs. Wallace cried about him to their mother, how she couldn't control him, how they had to send him away. Joe was alarmed.
What happened with Rick?
Gabe began the story.
Do you remember when Laura would see Lionel Casey? In the woods? Fuck, Gabe. Why would you bring up Lionel Casey?
Joe was looking at Rosie when he said it. She was thinking the same thing. Of all the people, and under these circumstances. First Rick, and then Lionel Casey, the homeless man who lived in the nature preserve. The man who was eventually found inside the car of Laura's dead boyfriend, and who'd spent his life in a mental facility as a result.
Listen, Gabe continued. I know it's hard to hear the name. But do you remember when we were little? When he used to wear that cape and walk the stone wall at the end of the pond? Laura said he looked like a vampire.
Rosie nodded reluctantly. The stories about the old hermit who lived in the deep woods of the nature preserve would have been funny now, as grown-ups, had things not ended the way they did, with Lionel Casey implicated in the death of Laura's boyfriend. "Of course we remember," Rosie said. Laura always made them run back to the house to get garlic and crosses. She loved tracking him, thinking she saw his footprints in the soil. "He stopped doing that long before."
"I know. But one time it was just the two of us. Me and Laura. I don't know why, or where the other kids were, where you two were. But she came running over, in the house to my room, banging on the door. She said he was out there again, with that cape, walking the wall at the end of the pond. God, I must have been 13 then. It was the last thing I wanted to do. We were getting older. Teenagers, you know. But Laura was still a kid, still wanting to have her adventures."
"I remember," Rosie said. "She used to beg us to play with her. She didn't like that things were changing. She felt like she was getting left behind. That's why I went with her. We walked the path to the pond, but there was no one on the wall. She said we should split up, that I should go one way and she would go another, both of us walking around the perimeter of the pond until we met up again. I started to wonder if she'd been making it up about Lionel Casey being out there that day. But I went along with it. I told her after we'd searched the perimeter, I was going home. She agreed, and I started walking. I made it halfway around and didn't see her. I thought maybe I'd been faster, so I kept walking in the same direction until I was back where we started, with no sign of Laura. It was so quiet that day. The trees were still bare. I called her name, then listened. I called it again. Still no answer. I didn't know where to start looking for her. I remember hearing nothing but my feet on the dead leaves. I thought maybe he'd been there. Maybe he wasn't just a harmless old hermit after all." Gabe stopped, and the room was as quiet as the woods he'd just described. Lionel Casey had not been a harmless old hermit, and all those years they'd gone into the woods, he'd been there. Hundreds of times, together, in pairs. Sometimes alone if one of them left before the others, never aware of the danger. "I went to the places I thought she would go, the field, the overlook, and then finally, the fort. Remember that fort we built? One piece of plywood lodged between the trees?"
"We remember, Gabe. Please, just tell us what happened," Joe said.
Rosie couldn't speak or move. She could barely breathe, thinking about her sister out in those woods with Lionel Casey.
"She was there, in the fort, but not with Casey. She was there with Rick, and he had a knife to her throat."
Rosie gasped, hands to her mouth.
"What?" Joe said, his voice raised with anger. "It was just his stupid pocket knife, but still, he was holding her by the hair with the knife, and I just fucking lost it. My brother had been a pain in the ass, but this was beyond anything he'd done before. Seeing Laura like that, it was too much. We got into a fight, rolling on the ground, kicking and punching each other. And then all of a sudden, he was off me, lying on the ground, holding his head."
Gabe placed his hand on his head as though acting out the scene. All of them were picturing this moment, knowing what was coming.
"I looked back," he continued. "And there was Laura, holding this stick with both hands, white-knuckled, hair clinging to the sides of her face that was wet with mud and tears. She was a wild animal. She came at him again, and I got up and grabbed the end of the stick. I got it away from her. My brother stood, cursing at both of us, but he ran, back to the house. Of course, I told my mother what he'd been doing to Laura with that knife. He said he was just trying to scare her because he thought she was so tough. But that's when he left."
"Before the year was up," Rosie said. "I always wondered why your parents didn't wait until the end of the term."
"Jesus Christ, Gabe, what are you saying? What do you think this story means?"
"I don't know. It's just a story. But I have this image in my head of Laura, like a wild animal, holding that stick, swinging it at my brother's head. If I hadn't stopped her..."
"That's enough,"
Joe held up his hand. Enough. Was this the only time it happened? Did your crazy-ass brother hurt her again?
I don't know. Honestly.
Rick wasn't about to tell me, and Laura never wanted to talk about it.
But God, I think about how angry she always was, and I have to wonder if my brother was the cause of it.
No, Rosie wouldn't hear any more. I don't believe it. If it had been more than that one incident, she would have said something. She would have done something about it.
Maybe, Gabe said. I hope you're right.
The thing is, we're at a crossroads right here and right now.
You already said, Rosie, that one of two things happened last night. And if it's the one I think it is, maybe we give her some time.
Time for what? Joe asked. What have you two been discussing?
Rosie looked at Gabe, but didn't answer.
You think she hurt this guy, and now we should give her time to get away? Like some criminal? Seriously?
Gabe was about to answer when they heard the sound, the ping on Laura's laptop.
Rosie rushed back to the table and stared at the screen. Joe was right behind her.
No!
Joe grabbed her by the shoulders, but he had no words to calm her.
The message was from a woman with the screen name Second Chance. It was short. One word. All caps.
Do you know this man? Had been the question.
The answer was brief.
Run.
Chapter 13. Laura. Session number 9. 2 months ago, New York City. Dr. Brody.
I'm sorry, Laura. It must be very hard to carry such a heavy burden.
Laura. Which one? I've always felt burdened by something. Dr. Brody.
The guilt.
Laura. Ah, right. That one. Chapter 14. Laura. The night before. Thursday, 9:30 p.m. Branston, Connecticut. We don't make it far. He takes the same way back, and we are stopped at a light on Grand Street. A bodega is on the right. Young men with their pants halfway down their asses crowd around the entrance. Yes, they still do that in downtown Branston. They haven't gotten the memo. On the left, two old women sit on the stoop of a dilapidated townhouse, their knees spread wide, even though they wear skirts. There's nothing to see but white granny panties, and they couldn't give a shit. Jonathan plays music again. He hasn't spoken since we got in the car down by the water. Finally, he does.
I have a confession, he says.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So what is it? Do we really need to go through all of this? Just spit it out. He sighs. He says,
okay.
Of course. Then he tells me,
I Googled you.
I shrug. I Googled you. I thought that was normal.
What did you find out?
How is this now about me? I don't have a confession, not one I'm willing to make. Still, I answer, seeing as we are playing a little game. Nothing, actually. No Jonathan Fields matched your picture. But I didn't try very hard, to be honest. There are a lot of you. He sighs again. He says, okay, again.
My last name isn't Fields.
Fuck. What is it, then?
Fielding.
And you lied because... My heart bangs against the walls of my chest.
That woman, the one from the bar, she found my ex-wife using my last name. She tried to friend her on social media, Facebook and LinkedIn, followed her on Instagram. We don't speak much, so I didn't know. I couldn't warn her. They started messaging each other.
That's crazy, I say. And it is.
It was benign at first, but then she started asking questions about me, and when my ex-wife got suspicious and cut her off. She started saying all this stuff about what an asshole I was and how could she have married me and what kind of an idiot was she because I probably cheated on her the whole time. Stuff like that.
I think about this as the light turns. So why are you telling me now?
What do you mean?
He doesn't glance at me because he's driving again. My heart slows, the volume clicked down to a tolerable level. This all sounds reasonable in the world of online dating. Not that I would know, but that doesn't stop me from accepting his explanation. She didn't flip out on you until you slept with her on the third date and then ended things, which I have to admit still has me curious about what happened in that bedroom that you found strange but turned her into a strung-out addict for more of you and whatever it is you had going on that night. This gets me a smile, or maybe a snicker. Don't you think you should have waited to tell me? You haven't even given me a fighting chance to go psycho on you yet. Another smile, another light. This time we have an empty street corner on one side and a deserted park on the other. He takes the opportunity to look at me.
It's the first time I've lied about my name. It feels wrong. Like if we ended up seeing each other again, it would be too late to tell you, and then I would have messed things up.
Sweet Jesus Christ. He might want to see me again. Happy. Lying will mean the end. Sad. Confusion sets in. I'm not good with confusion. So, I say, struggling now. Is that your confession? Light turns, car doesn't move. He doesn't see the light because he's looking into his lap with his eyes closed.
No,
he says. Now I'm worried. What's so bad that he can't even drive the car? A pimped-out pickup truck pulls up behind us, lights blinding as they pour into the Toyota. Then a honk. Jonathan Fields, scratch that, Fielding, drives through the light and pulls over at the curb.
I googled you,
he says again. I know, you said that.
I found you.
The engine hums as it sits idling. We are beside the park, which has a fence running along the side of the road. Not a soul in sight now that the wife beaters have driven past. I consider my options. They aren't good. Did he stop here on purpose to tell me that he's found me? I play it cool. Okay, I say.
I mean you, the real you, not Laura Hart. Laura Lochner.
So we both lied about our last names. Is that what you mean? He shakes his head. I knew he would. I was just buying time. Think. Think. There's the door handle, the street, the deserted street, and the fence and the bodega two blocks away.
I get it, he says. I mean, I would use a different name, too.
I stop him right there. How did you find my real name? The best defense is a good offense.
There were no Laura Harts who matched your photo. But Hart is your middle name, so an image came up with all three. Names, that is. All three names. Laura Hart Lochner.
I don't know if I believe him. I've been so careful. I googled myself before I started this misadventure, and I didn't see any images of me with all three names. But then again, I didn't look at every image. Maybe he has more patience. Maybe he's more careful because of that woman. Or maybe he's more careful for other reasons. Or maybe he already knew. Okay, I say again, only this time with resignation. I'm cornered.
Look, he says, I read all of it, every article I could find about what happened. And obviously, I still came to meet you, so...
I don't let him finish. Are you a reporter or something? He gets offended, but I can't tell if it's rehearsed. Reporters can be sneaky as hell.
No, he insists. I told you. I just wanted to make sure I knew what I was getting myself into.
I could say the same. I pull out my phone, prepared to Google Jonathan Fielding, but my phone is dead. I don't know when it died, but it's dead. He hands me his phone.
Do you want to check? It's only fair.
I push his hand away. No, I say. What am I going to find that could even come close? I face the executioner straight on. I feel him hang my hope first so I can watch it die before my eyes. That's what they used to do to exact the maximum punishment, hang the co-conspirators one at a time, making them watch. So what do you want to know? Everything is right there, in the articles you read. It was 11 years ago, so there's plenty of them. He tries to find my eyes, but I can't bear it.
It's okay, he says.
Suddenly, I can't stand that word.
Look, I just wanted you to know that I knew, like with my last name. I like you, and I don't want to start out with lies.
I close my eyes, count to 5, then 6, then 7. I'm still counting when he speaks again.
Something happened to me when I was a teenager. Something traumatic like that. I mean, not just like that, but similar in that it stayed with me, hung over me for years. I think it still does.
He waits for me to engage, but I'm still counting numbers, looking straight ahead. My hand is on the handle of the door. I can't stand this conversation. I can't go back there, to that night. I was an idiot to come home and think the past wouldn't be here waiting for me. He keeps talking.
I was at the beach with some friends. We used to go there to drink and hang out. It's a small town where I grew up. Cops turned a blind eye. Anyway, we saw this old guy out there in the ocean. He was swimming laps, back and forth in the moonlight. We didn't pay any attention after we realized what he was doing. You know, just swimming.
I try to listen. I try to focus on Jonathan's story. But the woods are pulling me back.
Then all of a sudden he stopped, like he was too tired or something. He waved an arm and called out to us. I took off my shoes and started running toward the edge of the water. A girl was on her phone calling 911. The other kids were like, "What are you doing? He could drown you." And I knew they were right. But it just seemed wrong not to try to help him.
He pauses, and I realize I should be having a reaction, and, "Oh my God, what did you do?" or "What happened next?" But I haven't been listening closely enough. Something about the beach and a man swimming. He continues without me.
By the time the police came, he'd gone under, just like that. I will never forget that sight, watching his head disappear, and then the very last thing to go into the black water, the hand that was waving for help.
I say it then. So what happened?
He drowned, that's what happened. Right in front of my eyes, and I did nothing to help him. I didn't even try.
I find more words.
What could you have done?
He shakes his head like he's heard this 1,000 times, and I wonder if he tells the same story to every woman from findlove.com. I wonder if he told it to that crazy woman who stalked his ex-wife. I wonder if it's even true.
Nothing. I know. He was too far away for me to have gotten to him, and I didn't have any training or anything. He could have grabbed me and pulled us both down. I know all of that. Still, the sight of it haunts me. That hand just disappearing.
Long pause. Heavy sigh. He's waiting for my confession now. I don't give it. Instead, "I'm sorry. That must be very hard, to carry such a burden." I got that line from the shrink.
"Anyway," says Jonathan Fielding.
This is his second favorite word, and I hate that I'm finding things not to like, things I can use later, after it ends badly, to convince myself he was all wrong. "Anyway."
"So when I read about what happened when you were in high school, I understood a little bit about how these things can happen and then affect you for the rest of your life."
I smile. It comes over my face like a mask.
"I read everything I could find. One of the articles said that they'd found the car abandoned at the other end of the preserve, deep in the woods, and some homeless man sleeping inside it."
"Lionel Casey," I say finally. "Might as well."
"Right, Lionel Casey," he repeats after me. "He never went to trial because he was found mentally incompetent. He died in an institution still claiming to be innocent."
I shake my head. "Yes, I say. Long pause, and then,
do people still think you did it? Is that why you don't use your real name?
I look at him now, and I don't know what I see. My mind has gone there, back to those woods, back to that car, back to that night. And he has become part of it now, this burden of all burdens. My hand squeezes the handle, and before I can stop myself, I am out of the car, running alongside the fence to the park. I hear him call my name.
Laura!
I hear another car door shut, and my name, louder this time.
Laura, stop!
I run and run until I find the entrance, and then I am in the park, the dark, littered park, that I pray will swallow me up. Jonathan Fielding is fast, faster than I am in my high heels, and I have a new theory on why men invented them. I feel his hand grab hold of my arm and yank me back so that I fall into him and we are both on the ground.
Jesus Christ,
he says, standing up, brushing himself off.
What's the matter with you?
I don't get up or brush myself off or do anything except stare at this stranger whose name I don't even know.
I'm sorry, he says. I shouldn't have asked you that. If people thought you killed that boy, please.
He reaches his hand out, but I don't take it.
I wasn't implying that you... I was just trying to relate. To understand what you might be going through being back here, where it all happened.
I'm listening again. He pulls me back with what sounds like reason. Then he looks around us. The park is silent, but ominous somehow, like we have silenced it, like it's waiting to come back to life and feast on us. People have been murdered in this park over car keys and wallets.
We shouldn't be here. Let me drive you back to town at least. Please, Laura.
He reaches out his hand again, and this time I take it and pull myself up to stand. I brush the dirt from Rosie's dress. We walk, quickly, back toward the entrance. He doesn't stop talking, explaining.
People said things about me, too. About all of us who were at the beach that night. They asked why we didn't try to save him.
It's not the same. Not even close. But I let him continue. We get to the car. He opens my door and I get inside. Again, for the third time, I get in his car.
I really just didn't want there to be any lies between us so early on. That's all. That's why I wanted to tell you I knew and tell you that I understood, so you wouldn't think that I thought badly of you. God, I'm making it worse, aren't I?
Jonathan Fielding is a talker now. He knows just what to say, because I believe every word. I've crawled deep inside our story, the story of me and Jonathan, and I only see what is right in front of me. I don't see that 2 days ago I'd never heard of him and he had never heard of me. I don't see that our story is now chapters long, filled with questions and explanations and secret investigations into the lives we were not ready to reveal. That woman in the bar, that night in the woods, the holes in his story. Am I doing it again? Am I constructing him, writing our story to fit my desires? I can ask all I want. There is no one there to answer. I'm alone with my defective mind. Alone. The story of my life. And in spite of everything I know but can't see, that's the only story I want to end.
Chapter 15. Rosie, present day, Friday, 2:45 p.m., Branston, Connecticut. A second email arrived soon after the first. The same woman from findlove.com who had sent the first email. The one that said, simply, run. And now the second one. He's not who he says he is. Gabe responded, asking for more information. He didn't tell her about Laura missing. He didn't want to scare the woman off. He said it was important. I need to know if this is the same guy. What name did he give you? Did you get his phone number or an address? That was all they needed. Something to ID the guy. They waited for over 2 hours, but there was no further reply. Gabe went home, beckoned by his jealous, needy wife, leaving Rosie and Joe to take turns watching the screen. Rosie paced the room, Mason in her arms. He was looking for attention now. He could sense something was wrong. Very wrong.
"Where did she go?" Rosie asked. "Seriously, why would she tell us those things but then disappear?"
Joe shrugged. "We don't know what she even means by any of this. Maybe she just got burned. Maybe she's just pissed and wants us to think things about him. And now she's changed her mind."
Rosie kept walking around the kitchen island, her eyes darting between Joe and the computer and the door, still hoping to see Laura burst through it as though nothing was wrong. Joe kept talking.
"It's after 5, Rosie. I know what Gabe was saying, but—
It's crazy. That story about Rick and Laura."
They'd both been saying it, reeling in the chaos Gabe had left in their kitchen. "I can't believe we didn't know. That she didn't tell us. That he didn't tell us. And you know Mrs. Wallace told your mother, or something close to it. She told your mother everything. And then your mother never said a word."
"You're right. We should call the police," Rosie said, thinking out loud.
Joe came to her side and wrapped his arms around her and their son. "Okay. And I'm going to call a sitter. He likes Zoe the best, right?"
Rosie nodded and stroked Mason's soft hair. Then she looked to her phone and dialed 911.
She gave them the address, told them the situation. A unit was dispatched. "Fuck," Joe said when she was done. "Here we go."
He got up from the table and took Mason from her arms. He called the sitter and begged for her to come, even just to take Mason to the park for an hour. He put him in a booster seat and turned on cartoons. He gave him some cookies and milk to distract him. Then he refreshed the computer screen. Still, nothing more. No more messages. Rosie stood at the window in the family room, watching the street. "Do you think Rick Wallace did something to her? Is that what Gabe was trying to tell us?"
She was talking to herself now. Joe remained in the kitchen, watching her stare at nothing. "I don't know, Rosie."
The car appeared. No lights, no siren. It pulled to the curb and stopped. Doors opened, then closed. Rosie was waiting for them on the front walk. "My sister didn't come home last night." She explained it all in the kitchen.
"I'll take Mason upstairs until Zoe comes. Maybe he'll nap. Maybe I can see if I can find anything else in Laura's things."
Joe made excuses to leave the room. Mason knew cops only came when there was trouble. The officers sat at the table, taking notes.
Findlove.com, Jonathan Fields, the bartender, the woman they'd found using a fake profile.
Those three letters. R, U, N.
Rosie gave her name, Rosie Farrow, then her sister's name and description.
She pulled up a photo for them to see. Age, last address, height, weight, the color of her eyes. Rosie hadn't spoken to the police since that night 11 years before. What if she was wrong? That night was upon her now, as she described her sister.
"Can you spell your sister's last name?"
The letters stuck in her mouth as she searched for a sign of recognition. L, O, C. The younger of the two was a woman, Officer Pearson. She looked to be 25, maybe 30.
She would have been a teenager herself that night Rosie heard Laura scream.
The older one was a man, Officer Conway. He was closer to 40, wedding ring around his finger and some extra pounds around his waist. He would have been on the force back then.
"What time did she leave the house?"
Rosie pulled herself back. Sorry, what was that?"
"The time," Officer Pearson asked again. "That your sister left the house?"
She gave them the time, as well as Laura's phone number and email address. "A friend of ours was able to get the location where her phone died. He has a contact at the carrier, but that was all he could get. It's been dead since then."
Officer Conway flipped his notepad back a few pages, pretended to read something. "So that's how you found this bar,
where someone recognized a photo from possible men on this website?
Rosie nodded. That was our first lead. Now we have a woman on the site who knows him.
Now Pearson.
But you don't know for certain that your sister was with him last night, or that this photo belongs to the man she was communicating with. Is that right?
Nothing is certain. That's why we need her phone records and emails and access to her account on the website. She spoke to him on the phone. I know that for a fact. His number will be there.
Now Conway. You know because she told you?
Yes, because she told me. She got dressed up for a date. She brought nothing with her but a purse. She was going to meet this man, Jonathan Fields. His number will be there.
Rosie could see the doubt creeping in. Laura hadn't been gone a day yet.
You need warrants, right? Can you get them or not?
Rosie asked. Pearson and Conway exchanged a look.
It's up to a judge, but most likely not until morning. We can put out a locate on your car, Pearson said.
Rosie pounded her fist on the table.
No, I told you, we found the car. It was parked on Richmond. We drove it home. It's right there, in the driveway.
Conway now. So the car isn't missing. Just your sister?
Yes.
Two heavy sighs. Then the officers stood up.
We have her social security number, Rosie said, handing a piece of paper to Conway. What happens now?
We'll file a report. Likely not much happens until tomorrow, unless there's more that surfaces between now and then to indicate a crime has occurred. Most of these cases, the person shows up.
Conway tried to sound sympathetic, but it came off as patronizing. Rosie stood, helpless, as both officers walked to the door.
And it doesn't matter that we know she wouldn't do this, she asked, following behind them.
Pearson answered without stopping.
Like my partner said, they usually turn up.
There'd been no promises, no sense of urgency. They didn't seem to recognize the name, but that would happen the minute they put it in the system. Laura Lochner, the girl found next to a dead body, the murder weapon in her hand. The decision to call them had felt monumental, as though they would find Laura in an instant, even if it came at the cost of dredging up the past. But the car drove off, again with no sirens, no lights, nothing. Joe returned from upstairs. He checked the screen, then looked up at Rosie, shaking his head. There was nothing new.
What's happening?
Joe came closer. He was moving slowly, ominously. He had papers in his hand.
What?
Rosie asked. She didn't like what she saw on his face. He handed her the papers, three of them, typed notes. I found these in her room, in the pockets of her coat.
Just like she used to do, Rosie said.
When she was a teenager, Laura would hide things from their mother in her coat pockets, coats worn in a different season, shoved into the back of the closet. It could be anything, cigarettes, condoms, her phone. Not that their mother ever bothered to look. Rosie opened the first note.
I know what you did.
Then the second one. You should never have come back. And the third. You will pay. Rosie stared at the notes, reading them over and over. Joe stood beside her, holding her by the arms. She looked at him hard, trying to gauge the amount of fear in his eyes.
Did you know about these?
It wasn't the same as hers, her fear at seeing these notes. It changed everything. Joe was indignant. What are you asking me?
Did Laura tell you about these? Where they came from? Who might have sent them?
He let go of her and walked away, then turned back. I can't believe you would ask me that. Don't you think I would have told you? If not right away, then certainly this morning when she didn't come home. Rosie couldn't answer him because she didn't know what to think anymore. There had been so many conversations that seemed to hush when they heard Rosie coming down the stairs or around the corner. Laura and Gabe and Joe. Sometimes just Laura and Joe.
Maybe she told him about the notes. Maybe she told him other things as well. Do you know?
Rosie asked finally.
Know what?
She couldn't say the words. She'd never said them, never asked the question, not in 11 years.
What, Rosie? Just say it already.
And then they came, escaping from her mouth before she could catch them. The words, the question she didn't want answered. Did she tell you she killed him? It had always been there, this question, hanging over all of them since that night. All they ever knew was what Laura told the police. She was in the car with her boyfriend. The door opened from the driver's side. A man dragged him out. Laura heard the crack of wood against bones, then a cry. She crawled out the other side and hid in the brush by the side of the road. The man swung the bat twice more, then got in the car and drove away. They held her for 24 hours until the car was found, deserted in another part of the reserve, deep in the woods. Lionel Casey had made it his new home. Laura was never charged. Still, the question lingered. Why was she found standing over the body, the bat in her hands, blood on her clothing? Rosie asked it again. Did she tell you she killed that boy? Joe shook his head.
No.
Then she stood in the silence, wondering things about her husband, wondering things about her sister. What she had done all those years ago to a boy in the woods. Her first love. A boy named Mitch Adler. And what she might have done last night to a man named Jonathan Fields.